Support for this public radio podcast comes from AIG Travel Guard, providing travel insurance designed to help travelers face the unexpected. Learn more at travelguard.com.
Welcome to Profiles. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Lori Burns McRobbie, the new First Lady at Indiana University. Lori, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Your new title, First Lady of Indiana University, what does that mean to you when you hear that title or you hear yourself addressed as the First Lady?
Well, I have to admit, I've gotten over this, but initially my first instinct was to look behind me to see about whom they were speaking. It's not really a title that I ever have associated with me, but it really does, I think, more seriously convey the role that I play now and really a very important and time-honored role. I wasn't entirely sure if the title First Lady was going to be what I settled on or, like a lot of partners these days, choose presidential spouse or first spouse or something like that. First Lady, I have come to like it very much because it has a degree of independence about it, and I think also associated with a lot of legendary first ladies on the national stage, like Eleanor Roosevelt and so forth. And actually, Eleanor Roosevelt is a bit of a role model in the sense of someone who has her own agenda and her own vision and a very strong sense of public service and advocacy, which is what I hope to bring to this role here.
Lori, you've spoken a lot about your involvement and your interest in STEM education. Could you explain what STEM education is?
Sure. It's an acronym. It stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. And it's basically shorthand for an increased focus on increasing the numbers of students, young people, and so forth, who are going into those fields.
And what is it that's claimed your attention about this area? Because I know you come from a background of having studied history, if I remember correctly.
Right. My undergraduate degree is in history. And I actually started out to be an academic and got, well, not quite sidetracked, but I found myself took a job working for the state networking organization in the state of Michigan as a way to bring in some income while my first husband and I were starting our family. And that happened to be just after the basic protocols that underlie the internet that we all know and use today were standardized. And so there was a huge wave of implementation and deployment going on of networking. It was right after the PC was invented. And so there were all these very creative people caught up in this major wave of innovation, probably one of the most significant waves of innovation in the 20th century. And this was in the early 80s, actually, about 10 years before the internet hit the commercial marketplace. Mm-hmm. But it was very much very, very active in research education and higher education. And it was a very exciting time, and I just got hooked. And so 25 years later, I wound up being a technologist, sort of by accident. With that background and also being female in those fields, those two things have combined to motivate me to be an advocate for increasing the numbers, particularly of women and minorities in STEM fields, because they have been so heavily underrepresented in those areas traditionally and still today.
What was it, do you think, when you were drawn to that very new world back in the early 80s of when computers were just beginning to get on scene, what was it that got you so hooked and so excited about it?
Well, I think it was a couple of things. One was the people, everyone from the network engineers and programmers to technical writers and people sitting on the help desk were very interesting and creative people. I think it's perhaps a perception that some might have that engineers, for example, are kind of cut and dried people, and instead they are really highly creative and very interesting. And I think I just was attracted to the culture of innovation and the culture of creativity that I experienced working with all those folks. And I think it simply was the fact that it was new. No one else was doing it. I kind of got to be a little bit of first kid on the block, at least in my family. And part of that was recognizing that because I didn't come out of that background, because I came out of a humanities background and I thought about things perhaps a little differently, that I had something to offer.
I know that you talk about the fact that you have a dedication to bringing women and minorities, folks who have been underrepresented in the fields of what we consider the scientific or the hard fields, right, in education. Where does that dedication come from, and where has that, to coin a phrase, where has it stemmed from to want to bring other folks and really open that field up to be much more accessible to those who have been traditionally underrepresented in that field?
Well, I think that it's partly for the sake of those individuals, for women and minorities, in the sense that we have now this knowledge-based economy. The jobs that are going to pay well will be those that require some degree of science and math literacy, and just basic economic equality, I think, is a big piece of that. But I think it's also about bringing diversity to those professions and those disciplines and those jobs. Certainly my experience being female in a predominantly male workforce, it was, first of all, a very comfortable experience for me by and large. I was lucky enough to work for very supportive bosses, very supportive colleagues. They were always willing to sit down and teach me things if I needed help, rarely made me feel stupid. I managed to do that all on my own. I think what I saw happening over my time in those jobs was over and over again, the benefits of diverse perspectives being brought to bear on solving problems. And almost more than anything else, for the long term, I think that's really the key reason that I feel so strongly about increasing the numbers of underrepresented individuals in those fields.
Lori, I know that you've spoken about a longstanding dedication to women's issues. When you say women's issues, first of all, let me give you a chance to define what you mean by that and where that dedication and purposefulness comes from for you.
First of all, I think I have to say I prefer almost not to define it because it allows for a lot of freedom in choosing, you know, what one might pursue under that heading. But more seriously, I think it really is about, for me at any rate, it's about being interested in how women's lives have changed over the years. I mentioned before my undergraduate degree is in history, and I was particularly focused on women's history. And I have just been very interested in how women's lives have changed as the world around them has changed, around us has changed, and certainly going into the future, how women interact with their lives, with their families, their lives with their communities, as well as their lives with the workforce and with, you know, global issues and politics and all those things. That's a sense in which it's nice to keep it very broad and very open. I also was, in essence, raised by a single mother. My father passed away when I was fairly young, and I had three siblings, and so starting from age 11, she was my sole parent, and she was a wonderful role model for me. She served on city council in Ann Arbor in the 60s. She ran for mayor in 1965, wow. Unsuccessfully, but still the attempt was very significant for me. So I saw this very strong woman up close as I grew up, and coupled with the rise of feminism in the late 60s and early 70s, it was a short step for me to see that as an important part of my life and something I wanted to be very well, not only to understand how women, the situation for women got to be where it was and is in my lifetime, but also how I can help to make things better. So STEM education is a piece of that. Again, the diversity that women bring to those fields, as well as ensuring that the economic and workplace advantages of those jobs are available to women.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Lori Burns McRobbie, the First Lady of Indiana University. Lori, I heard you tell a great story about how when you came to Bloomington, you were introduced into a community of very active women here through Charlotte Sitlow. And do you mind telling that? Because you just talked about your mom and what a great role model she is for you, and how that incident happened for you would be great to hear.
Well, I was at a Rotary luncheon a year ago last March, I think it was, and heard Charlotte give a talk. I had not met her before, although I think we were scheduled to have lunch. And she was talking about her experiences here in Bloomington, the first woman on city council, starting a business. And as I listened to her, I thought, boy, she reminds me of my mother. Again, she had been on city council and so forth. So after Charlotte's talk, I went up and introduced myself and told her that she reminded me of my mother and started to explain why. And I got about halfway into my sentence about my mother being on city council and so forth. And she stopped and looked at me and said, "You Eunice Burns's daughter?" And it turned out that Charlotte and Paul, her husband, had gotten their PhDs in Ann Arbor in the early 60s. And she worked on my mother's first council campaign. So they had actually met these two women. And Charlotte is, I mean, we'd sort of joke about this, that she's kind of my Bloomington mother. I think she's a lot of people's Bloomington mother. She's a wonderful woman. And it was through that connection that I got introduced to Middleway House.
Tell me a little bit. I know you're on the board at Middleway, and you're also very involved with the Wings campaign. How did you get you got involved through meeting Charlotte and Middleway, and what propelled you to get onto the board there?
Charlotte introduced me to Toby Strout, and Toby spent an afternoon with me.
She's
the executive director of Middleway. She introduced me to Middleway House's operations. I got a tour of some of their facilities and had a chance to talk with her. And I was so impressed by and drawn to the organization because it takes such a comprehensive approach to addressing the needs of women coming out of violent domestic situations, not just emergency shelter and legal advocacy and rape crisis, but the next step of helping with transitional housing and even longer term housing, of jobs by creating these micro businesses that Middleway has started up. And it's resulted in an amazingly low rate of return by those women to their abusers. Middleway House is a national model program, and justifiably so, because of the work they do and the outcomes they get. It's probably as simple as it just spoke to me. It made a connection very deep, and I wanted to be part of the organization and help as much as I could. So I joined the board about a year ago, and a few months later, Toby and I discussed my taking on the role of chair of what's called the New Wings Community Partnership, which started as the capital campaign for the renovation of the old Coca-Cola bottling plant on South Washington, but is really more than that. It's longer term, a vehicle through which we're hoping to produce a sustaining source of funding from the community to kind of smooth out the bumps in state and federal funding, of which there are an increasing number of bumps.
So you're very involved with Middleway and the New Wings campaign, as well as I know that you speak all over the state. What do you do for relaxation, Lori? does that term exist in your life?
It does. It does. And in fact, I've been very sort of deliberate about this. I love yoga, and I do quite a lot of it. In fact, I've stepped it up since Michael became president, quite deliberately. I figure some deep breathing would probably serve me very well, and maybe him indirectly too. So that's a piece of it. I also try to stay fit and get a lot of exercise. And one of the things I do for exercise is walk. Both Michael and I love music and love living in Bloomington because of the feast we get to partake in on a nightly basis if we wanted to. So music is a big part of what I do to relax, and also just spending time at home with my kids. to the extent that they're there anymore.
Well, tell me, this is a good point for you to introduce the piece of music that you chose. I believe it's a piece by Bonnie Raitt, one of my favorite artists as well.
Well, it's actually the song, it's the title is Silver Lining. It's actually written by David Gray, who's a Welsh musician. And Bonnie Raitt recorded it on an album that she cut, I think, in 2002. It's called Silver Lining. That was during a period in my life when my first husband was dealing with his illness. And it really is a kind of an anthem for me of how to get through very dark times in one's life, of which I've had several, and inevitably in one's life one does have those moments of darkness and sorrow. And the song is about finding the silver lining and seeing optimism in the face of despair.
We've been listening to Bonnie Raitt and her song Silver Lining, and you're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Lori Burns McRobbie. Lori, you spoke about the fact that you've had a lot of transitions, especially in the last few years. Loss, moving, marriage, a new blended family, a new role in terms of being First Lady at IU, new involvement in an organization like Middleway that you're giving so much energy to. When you think about getting through transitions, you talked about not giving into despair. What are some of the key things that help you move through transitions, both the difficult ones and the ones that call you to them?
Well, and they're all challenging. I mean, it's interesting. Even good ones, of course, require a lot of energy and time to get through. I think really it's being flexible. Well, maybe even both flexible and trying to establish routines as quickly as you can, so that things become a little bit more predictable and familiar. I think certainly I was helped by the fact that the happy transitions have been so happy and have not required a great deal of separation from my past life in Ann Arbor or changes in my family. I think coming to Bloomington is not just like Ann Arbor, but it's got a lot of similarities. It's not that far away and so forth. That helps, certainly. I think it's, as much as anything, it's believing that it's possible to make positive change, again, even in the face of things that are less positive, that life is about the blend of both the good and the bad, and you're never going to really be able to escape the bad things that happen, but you ought to make the best of the good. It sounds a little trite, but it really has worked for me. I think it's really the way that it becomes possible to survive change, particularly when that change is not under your control.
Mm-hmm. You spoke about Eleanor Roosevelt being a role model for you and your mom, Eunice Burns, being mm-hmm. a role model for you. What are some of the common characteristics that those women share, and are there other women that you also see as being role models?
They're very strong. That's probably also a general term to use, a little feisty, very passionate about their beliefs, about being committed to making something better, whatever the particular issue is that they are advocating for. And interestingly, and I hadn't really thought about this before, but thinking about my mother and Eleanor Roosevelt, she'd be delighted to hear me putting her in the same sentence as Eleanor Roosevelt. But they both, in different ways, when they came into their roles, it was not, in a sense, their choice. My mother, of course, losing her husband, she was already very engaged in the community, but it also required her to do probably more than she might have chosen to do, perhaps, had my father lived. Eleanor Roosevelt became First Lady. She was actually initially very, very upset during that famous first 100 days of Franklin Roosevelt's term in office, first term in office. She was very, very unhappy, was sure she was going to lose her sense of self, that she would simply disappear into the morass of Washington. This was a terrible thing for her. And obviously she got over that found a real calling. Again, thinking about transitions for both of them, I think I took some of that into my own life and making the best of the circumstances, taking the circumstances that are handed to you and doing something powerful with them. That's very important to me. And as I've gotten older, I'm over 50, and I've had all the experiences I've had. I've had the education I have. I have the confidence that I have. I need to be using that to benefit the community around me. And both my mother and Eleanor Roosevelt and dozens of other women and men that I could name have exemplified those same characteristics, and I only hope I can follow in their footsteps.
You spoke about one of your goals being to really increase minority and women's role in the science education, really having access to those opportunities. What are some of the ideas that you have for making that happen?
Well, mostly I think I'm trying to bring some visibility both to the issue and to what mainly what Indiana University is doing, but also what's going on in the state of Indiana and nationally as well, but also to be able to support and advocate for where there are some specific initiatives going on that could lead to some level of support, whether it's additional support for legislative action, financial action, and so forth. There is a statewide initiative in Indiana that IU is a partner in called iSTEM. Mm-hmm. And a big piece of that is dealing with mathematics curriculum change in secondary school. And a lot of it is around teacher training. I think we can probably all point to a teacher that we've had somewhere in our schooling that was transformational, that really made such an impact on us that it changed the way we think about a particular subject forever. And good teachers are gold. And the more we can support teachers, support their ongoing professional development, and particularly in those areas, be good science teachers, good math teachers, that I think is a particularly important issue and something, again, I would like to bring more visibility to and support the efforts that are going on to improve teacher training, ongoing professional development for teachers.
What are some other goals that you have? I know that you've got a lot on your plate between your emphasis on making technology more accessible to folks, making the quote-unquote hard sciences be a more open field, your involvement in Middleway and the New Wings campaign. What other goals have you set for yourself? And I know you're right at the beginning of your term here as First Lady, but what other goals have you set?
Well, the true answer is I really haven't, other than to be an advocate in areas where I think I can be helpful. That's both by design and by default, because it is early. But the by design part of that is that I really do this is a long-term experience that I'm at the start of. I hope Michael will be president for a long time. And so I want to take some time to look around, talk to people, understand the landscape, understand where I can be most helpful. It's important that I do those things that are supportive. And, of course, this is a fundamental goal of mine, to be supportive of my husband's agenda, because I believe very much in it and believe very much in him. Also, across the university broadly, there are undoubtedly going to be other kinds of issues that are important to the university community that I can be helpful to, and I just need to, in a sense, let them emerge in their time and then evaluate how I can help.
So your agenda is going to – you have a piece of you that wants to be responsive to what the needs are. And so setting an agenda too firmly could take you away from that, but you have other goals that you have in place.
Yes. I think it's also a bit of a risk for a presidential spouse, first lady or first gentleman, to get too engaged in the policy and practice of the university itself. That's not the role. And so being responsive, I think, is a little bit of insurance against jumping a little bit too deeply into something that might somehow be give the appearance of trying to be too directive about what the university should do. And that's actually something that I have to be – I'm conscious of it in part because of coming out of 30 years in the workforce, and I was – an executive director at Internet too. Before I stepped down from that job, I'm used to being in charge and making stuff happen. So it's part of this is also retraining myself to think in advocacy terms instead of operational terms.
How do you distinguish those two? That's a really interesting distinction.
Well, I think operational, maybe easier to say what I mean by operational is simply being in charge and laying out a body of work and directing staff to get that done and being responsible for the outcomes, being accountable for the outcomes, as opposed to advocacy, which is really supporting and making visible things that other people are doing. And not having a direct say in how that happens. Now, there's obviously a fine line there, there's a gray area there. So I'll certainly be trying to walk that line as I go forward.
You talked a lot about your role as an advocate, and how are some of the ways that you see yourself getting in touch with people in order to become more aware, get to know the campus better, get to know the university better, getting to know Bloomington better? What are some of the things that you're doing in accomplishing that?
Well, right now, I am doing a lot of responding. I think it's probably typical in the early going in a new presidency that there are lots of invitations to go meet with people, to attend certain events, and there's a lot of that has given me a way to get in touch with what's going on campus. An example of this was a dance marathon that just happened. Michael stopped by a couple of times. I was with him the second time. I knew that the dance marathon existed, but I had no idea how extensive it was, the degree of organization that goes into it, and, of course, the wonderful outcome. They broke $1 million this year for Riley Children's Hospital.
Wow.
So that's an example of something that I now have a much better sense of, certainly of that part of campus life here. And it really is, I should just say, as another comment on it, it's I think one of only a few programs like that across the country. So I feel very good about learning a little more about what the Dance Marathon does. I think it's a very important activity, and those students are very much to be congratulated on what they do. But beyond that, I think over the course of this next year, I am hoping to meet with student groups, meet with staff groups. I think through the kind of lens of women's issues, I want to understand a bit more about the various programs that are going on that touch on women students, and particularly in, as we talked about before, science and math disciplines, but certainly not limited to that. I will probably spend a fair amount of time doing that kind of visits on campus over this next year. And when I say campus, as we all know, IU has 8 campuses.
Right.
It's not just Bloomington, although Bloomington obviously is my home, so I feel particularly called to understand life here. But I will be also going around the state and have had brief visits to a couple of other campuses. I'm up in Indianapolis quite a lot and on the IUPUI campus quite a lot, but haven't really started to get to know those communities, those particular campus communities yet, and I will be doing that as well over the next year.
You've talked a lot about the fact that some of the things that sustain you are your exercise, yoga, music, your family life. What are some things long-term that you think will sustain you as your role as First Lady grows and changes?
I have to say the strength of my marriage is one of those things. I think both Michael and I feel extremely fortunate that we found each other, even not coming out of the kinds of experiences we had before we met. But we've only been married for 2 years, but I think, both picked well. That's certainly one thing. And, you know, I think as my children get older, and
how old's your youngest now?
Our youngest is 16. Actually, both my daughter and Michael's daughter are both currently 16. One's a high school junior and one's a high school senior. My youngest will be 17 very soon. And we both have children that are out of the house, one of whom works here at WFIU and just graduated from IU last spring. So I know from the fact that I now have adult children as well that it doesn't fortunately stop when they leave home. So I imagine that I will certainly be sustained by staying in touch with my children and how they're and as their lives develop and so forth. That I look forward to very much. You know, I think there are so many opportunities in the community and so many things going on around a university. I mean, I've grown up in higher education. My father was a college professor. I've never really known anything but life around a university, and very much value the richness that brings. So I imagine that as time goes on, I will always have accessible to me the kind of musical richness that we have in this community, and the literary richness and the intellectual richness, those sorts of things. I hope to be able to have more time at some point in the future to read more, attend lectures more, those sorts of things. And I find those very sustaining. I think that's a good word to use. It's not just a nice way to pass the time, but they really enrich one, I believe, certainly me, in a very deep way.
If one was to come into your home, what might you hear on the stereo?
Probably jazz or Led Zeppelin.
I was going to ask that.
But we tend to listen to jazz mostly in the evening and classical in the morning. I think I hadn't really thought about it that way, but that's actually what typically will happen depending on what time of day you come in.
And what books would I find on your nightstand or on your coffee table?
Well, let's see. On my nightstand, I'm usually reading two or three books at the same time. I'm actually in the middle of a book by Natalie Angier called The Canon, which is Natalie Angier is the science writer for The New York Times, or one of the science writers for The New York Times, and she's written a book about the big scientific issues of the day, as well as it's almost a primer on the basics of chemistry and the basics of physics written in a layperson's way. I always like to have a work of fiction, and I'm actually between books right now. But there's a book that by an Australian author that we were just given that I picked up and cracked the first two pages of, and I'm eager to get into, and I can't remember the name of it.
Do you have your top three favorite books? I know when people ask me that question, I would have such a hard time, and I know it shifts from time to time, but if you were going to say right off the top of your head what your top three favorite books, those books that come to mind when you think of what's been inspirational or that you go back to.
Yeah. One that comes to mind that I have read, I think, three times and each time have loved is Angle of Repose by Wallace Stegner. It's a book, it's fiction, but there are some real characters in the background. The Harriet Beecher Stowe's family, there are connections by the characters in that book, but it's a book about westward migration with a young couple at the center of the story So it has a lot about the development of the West and the development of social communities there, as well as the lives of the characters and the women in particular. And another book that I read as a young adult is Waterland by Graham Swift, which for a time I thought was the best book I'd ever read in my life. And I went back and read it again, and I decided it wasn't quite the best book I'd ever read, but it's a wonderful, wonderful story. Spoke to me. It's about a history professor. So when I read it, I was still in school studying to be a history professor, and that was probably why I thought it was so wonderful.
As you are coming into you, how long have you been First Lady now? It's been about...
Since July 1st.
How do you see the next year in terms, you've talked about getting to know the campuses, you've talked about getting to know life here, about getting to know people and about being an advocate. Do you have any visions of what you want to be able to say after your first year?
Well, I'd like to be able to say that I have at least a passing familiarity with all eight campuses. I would like to have just a greater sense of the landscape in terms of student life and staff life, in the sense how the operations of the university goes forward. We will be doing a fair amount of international travel. That's a big piece of Michael's vision for the university, and of course has been for years. Of course, Indiana's had a big focus on international relations, international studies. We'll be hopefully traveling. Well, I'll be going to China. We are hoping to get to India at some point, to Israel at some point, to Africa, particularly given the IU Kenya program with Moi University. Such a wonderful program. We'd like to be able to see.
Is that the AIDS Research Center?
That's the AIDS Research Center, right. I think gaining as much from those experiences is certainly a goal of mine, too, and we'll probably be making at least a couple of trips during this next year.
How do you feel about doing international travel? Are you excited?
Oh, I love it. You know, it's funny. I made my first trip overseas when I was 17. I graduated from high school a semester early and took off. My paternal grandmother had left each of her grandchildren some money to travel with because she felt that travel was the best education. So, of course, it was burning a hole in my pocket, and off I went. And I was desperately homesick the whole time I was gone. I was gone almost 3 months.
Where did you travel to, Lori?
Oh, it was kind of the grand tour, I guess. We started in Amsterdam and went south through Germany and Italy, Spain, France, England. Ended up in London. You know, Eurail Pass and Youth Hostel and Backpack. And it is kind of unbelievable to me now that I did that at age 17. And I shudder to imagine my children doing that, but I probably shouldn't. At any rate, I went back when I was a junior in college. I did a semester abroad, and that really was a transforming experience for me. And I think at that point, the second time, I was much more comfortable. And I did a lot of traveling when I was in my job, particularly with Internet, too. And you just get more comfortable with it. You develop routines. And I think, perhaps it's a artifact of the 21st century and how connected we are globally. But traveling has become just other countries are within our grasp, within reach and should be. And I really love being able to see other cultures and experience being out of my own element. And I'm just, I think, more comfortable with doing that now. So I always enjoy it and get a lot out of it.
One of the benefits of experience, isn't it, is that level
Absolutely.
Of comfort that comes.
Absolutely.
Tell me a little bit about, if you think toward the future, what would you like people to remember about you and about your role as First Lady?
Well, I think first and foremost, I want to have, and this sounds, again, a bit trite perhaps, but I want to have left a positive impact. I want to be remembered for having increased the close cooperation between the university and the community that surrounds it. I would like to be able to leave some impact on the Bloomington community in particular. Again, this is where I live. This is my home. I feel very, very much called to give back, as many of us do, unfortunately. There are lots of ways I hope to be able to do that over my time here. I'd also like to bring some new perspective, perhaps, to the role of First Lady. It's a very tradition-bound role, and that's because, of course, universities are also very tradition-bound places, but they are also places of great change, and I know that the ways in which increasingly people in this kind of a role, men and women, and increasingly men, I'm happy to say, will be different in this century than it was in the last century. I'd like to be part of redefining what it means to be the first lady, first person, if you will, of the university.
Lori, thank you so much for being a guest on Profiles. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
And a pleasure to speak with you too, Shauna.
Lori Burns McRobbie, First Lady of Indiana University. You've been listening to Profiles on WFIU, and we're going to listen to one more piece of music that you've chosen, Lori, and that's a piece by Ravel. And that piece, could you tell me which piece it is and why you chose
this
it?
This is the Ravel Piano Concerto in G. This was, and it's actually the second movement of the Ravel Piano Concerto in G. I grew up playing the piano. I, in fact, played into college, well, actually into my adult life. When my first husband and I moved into our first home, which was a 1,200 square foot house, there was room in the living room for my grand piano and nothing else. So when our first child was born, we needed a couch. So the piano, unfortunately, I had to sell it at that point, and I stopped playing. And I vowed at some point in the future, and later decided it would be when I came to Bloomington, I would start playing the piano again. The Ravel Piano Concerto was one of the last pieces that I actually attempted to start to play, and attempted is really the operative word here. Maybe I'll get back to it. I don't know, but it's wonderful to listen to nonetheless.
Thank you. We're going to listen to the Ravel Piano Concerto in G.
The second movement.
The program you just heard was recorded in November of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.